Good morning, I'm Tommy Howe, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International, a weekly natural science and public affairs program for the listeners of 107.7 The End and all of Western Washington, from the Columbia River to the San Juan Islands and everywhere in between. White salmon, hump tulips, yelm, Bremerton, Darrington, Cedar Woolley, Daybob Bay, Oak Harbor, Forks, Everson, Birch Bay, you name it. Be careful. And use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. Welcome to Tree Huggers International. Now, green building and sustainable design are a couple of new century catchphrases you may have heard batted around the last couple of years. Maybe you heard it at some parties or at some bars being used by folks who have no idea what they're talking about, but are trying to be hip and eco-friendly and pick up girls using the lingo. Although I must admit that's never worked for me. But joining us this morning at Tree Huggers International are three architectural professionals who do know what they're talking about. Craig Curtis and Mike Jobes from the Miller Hall Partnership in Seattle, and Brad Pease from the Seattle firm of Palladino & Company Green Building Strategies. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Welcome to Tree Huggers International. Great to have you guys here.
Thanks for having us, Tom.
Good morning. It's a pleasure.
Good morning. So tell me, what's the deal with the grass on top of the roof of the library in Ballard? What's going on there? How is that green design and green construction, aside from the obvious fact that there's grass on the roof of the building? I guess, basically, I hope they don't put any cows up there or anything, but can you guys...
Well, they just import a few goats now and then and take
care
of it.
Oh, right, exactly, yeah. If they're not cleaning the side of the five, you know...
Actually, that's one of the top 10 green buildings of 2006 is the Ballard Library, which is quite exciting. And the reason behind the green roof is it has a number of benefits that benefit all the residents of Ballard. One, the building looks great. I mean, you see that in the springtime and you see the flowers up there, and it really is a signature feature. But it also helps clean stormwater, so all the water that comes off the building is cleaned to prevent contaminants from going down into the fish hatcheries and helping manage our salmon population. So it's a great regional response to managing some of the problems we have up here in the Northwest.
Now, Craig, now Mike was sort of pointing over there. Now, did you have something to do with the library?
No, no, that was another architect in town, Bullen Swinsky Jackson, and they did a fine job with that project. It's great. We just did another project for Kitsap County, their administration building, with about an acre of green roof. But, you know, we're way behind the Europeans. The Germans have, I mean, they're so far ahead of us. They've been doing this for decades, and we're kind of following their lead on this a little bit. And the technology is now to the point where we can convince U.S. owners to want to, you know, take the chance of putting dirt and grass up on their roof in this kind of climate.
Is that... just more expensive? I mean, it seems like such an unusual thing to say in your building proposal. It's like, and on the ceiling and on the roof, we're going to have thick grass growing. I mean, as a layperson, I would imagine my first reaction would be, well, is it going to leak?
Well, you know, like I was saying, the technology's been there for quite a while, and it keeps getting better and better. And as far as costing more, I think that's getting closer and closer to evening out as well. And I know that, you know, Brad would be able to talk about this too, that with most of our owners, they've got a budget, and they want to see a payback period. So they may be willing to invest a little more up front to pay for a green roof, but they want to know, how long will it be until I reap the benefits economically from the extra insulation, from, you know, not paying for the extra stormwater detention, from all those things that I'm getting as a benefit, how long will it be before I see, you know, some real dollars in my pocket? So we end up doing that a lot with a lot of owners. You do a life cycle cost analysis and figure out how long it'll take to pay off the solar panels or the, you know, the extra insulation the American way.
The other thing that's a bit counterintuitive about a green roof is that a roof membrane left exposed to the weather goes through a huge heat and freeze cycle and breaks down. I mean, it's experiencing a huge range of temperature throughout the day or throughout the seasons. And when you put a green roof on top of it, when well done, it keeps the roof membrane, which actually keeps the water out, completely protected and in the same temperature range all the time. So the roof membrane thereby lasts a lot longer than it would have fully exposed if the green roof's assembled correctly.
You know what's great here, Tommy, is you recognize that roof and you saw it, and it's kind of novel, and I think people see it. It's visible. That's what's cool about that building, is you can see it. It's not hidden. It's not like a roof deck that is totally out of sight. It's in your face. And so people start talking about it. And to us, one of the best things we can do as architects and designers is try to change people's behavior. So just by doing a green building, sure, you know, that's cool. You're saving a little bit of energy. But if you get people talking about it, and then they want to try it, or they want to learn a little bit more about why, you know, why does that building look that way? Why does the roof look that way? Then they'll change their behavior potentially, or they'll tell their neighbor about it, and they'll do it. The same way with rain barrels. And there are a lot of things that are catching on the residential scale around Seattle that I think it's just, you know, getting the word out with some good buildings.
We've got Al Gore on the Academy Awards now talking about climate change. And it's really phenomenal, but everybody wants to know, how do you design a building that responds to that? And if you just look at the numbers of the average building in the U.S. accounts for 30% of CO2 emissions in building and operations. And if we look at carbon reduction figures put out by the Kyoto Protocol, it puts out an amazing number of metric tons that are responsible by buildings. So the response is, well, what do we do? And how do we make that change so rapidly? And certainly when we have signature green building features that may cost a little bit more on the roof deck but save you money on doing, because you don't have to install stormwater infrastructure to manage that water because you're doing it on the roof, and you can do it cost effectively, that's when you start to see the light bulb go off or go on. We like to call it go off in our office. But the idea is that small little perception change about, wow, you can put grass on the roof and you can maintain it and it looks great and we can save energy. Why aren't we doing it now? And that's what really starts to evolve the discussion that really is going to lead to the change that's mandated by our current climate crisis.
You know, I saw somewhere that New York was actually a remarkably green city for its size and its location in North America. I think I read this like in an in-flight magazine or something, but you know, one of the reasons that was cited for that was because people have gardens. Because there's a lack of green in a highly urbanized area like that. And if you can't afford to live next to Central Park, you might want to have your own green area on the roof of your building. And that was part of the reason that New York was coming off as green. But are they also building green in that part of the country as well? Are they building in an eco-friendly manner?
Certainly. If you look at Battery Park right now, they have incredibly stringent standards for energy efficiency and the location of the building and certain measures that have to be implemented from an indoor air quality perspective, as well as fresh air requirements and things like that. And they're having incredible results out there. And they're actually finding that the buildings are running out quicker and people want to live in those types of buildings. And it's really starting to change the market in New York completely because of these standards that have been implemented by Battery Park.
The other huge factor that makes New York a really green city is density. Density is a huge concept in sustainability, in that more people are concentrated in one place, which is reducing their physical footprint. And then by stacking, we're almost insulating each other and reusing the same energy to heat the next apartment up. So density, clustering a lot of people in one area is a huge factor.
And that would have had its genesis in Europe and certainly in parts of Asia. But I know in Europe, a lot of those towns are they're densely packed, and then you have X amount of woodland between these towns. And I know in Vancouver, that's a real big thing right now. And I think it's the west side of Vancouver. They're really just building up instead of building out. Of course, like Seattle, they don't have a whole lot of room to go and build out. But yeah, so is there a lot of European basis for that idea of civic development?
You know, I think that's just kind of evolved. But obviously, the downtown housing has really taken off here. And you see that all over the country. A lot more people want to live downtown. And that just, you know, keeps cars off the road and things like that. But, you know, even in bigger developments, I think there's a real movement towards sustainable design. We've been asked recently to participate in a couple of major suburban, or not even suburban, rural new town developments, where developers are now looking at buying very large tracts of land, but only building on a very small percentage of it and leaving the rest of it putting it into a conservation easement. Mike's working on a project in just outside of Albuquerque, New Mexico, where they've got 8,000 acres and we're building on how many of the...
Yeah, they bought a 12,000-acre ranchero that went on the market. They're buying it slowly, and they're developing only 300 acres of it into a village. The rest is going to be preserved.
And that requires a change in land use code. And so we need to start getting all of these counties and the larger governmental agencies on board with the idea of, instead of carving up your land into 20-acre parcels, or 5 or 10 acres or whatever, you know, save the land and put people in a more dense situation and give the rest of that land back to the people who will live there.
I was going to say, that's really an extraordinary amount of available open land for a private landholder. That's really remarkable. That's not the norm.
It's pretty much only available in the American West, and it won't be available for much longer. But those large tracts that are coming on the market, they're more likely to be coming into the hands of a developer like the one we're working with now than the developers that would just sprawl housing evenly across it and make it pretty much go away.
Why do you think that's becoming in vogue now? Is that cost effective? The folks that you work for, your clients, I mean, as you mentioned, Craig, they want to see where's the cash flow start coming back our way. But if we're leaving this much land undeveloped, we're not getting an immediate return on the investment.
Well, they must be getting it, though, because they wouldn't do it if it didn't make financial sense. So I think the market is demanding it. You know, even in the PI I saw recently, where they're going to start listing green features in the in all of the real estate ads for homes, new homes, it's going to be a requirement. That's what people are asking for. They don't care so much of whether they have a two-car garage. They want to know whether, you know, VOCs have been used, you know, in the paint or in adhesives, or, you know, is there good air quality in this house, and how much energy is it going to use? Those kind of things are more important. And I think people are willing to live in a denser neighborhood if they know that they've got access to this great natural landscape.
You know, when my wife and I started to look for a house, we, you know, didn't have a lot of money at the time, and we were challenged with two options, which was, one, we buy small and live in Ballard, or we go somewhere up way up north and deal with a 2-hour commute coming in. And to us, it was a no-brainer. I can take the bus down to work and get there on express in 15 minutes. I can walk to the local grocery store. There's of course, great coffee shops and the Ballard Library. Now, if I'm living up in other parts of the region, then I'm having to get in my car and do that, as well as deal with the commute. So I think for a lot of people, the idea to live dense is really about community and understanding that, yes, you can save money and you can save energy, but you're really establishing a community where you know the local barkeep down the street.
If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International on 107.7 The End. My name is Tommy Howe, and I'm joined by Craig Curtis and Mike Jobes from the Miller Hull Partnership in Seattle, and also Brad Pease from the Seattle firm of Palladino & Company Green Building Strategies. So it sounds as though the general idea these days, and this is more of an urban planning idea than an actual nuts and bolts architectural idea, but it seems as though that perhaps after World War II, where GIs are coming back and, you know, the population is expanding out into the burbs, it seems now that it might be kind of receding because it's more cost effective and it might improve your quality of life because you aren't driving 20 minutes or 30 minutes.
Right. Well, we are not living the 1950s now, and so we shouldn't be building like it's the 1950s when there was an abundance of land that people could go out and purchase. Now we're dealing with the abundance of traffic, and nobody wants to deal with that, so people are choosing to live closer to the city.
And not only an abundance of traffic, but there is a real lack of water. I would imagine that's a big problem in New Mexico and a lot of the American West, where cities like Salt Lake City and Denver and Southern California and certainly Arizona, these wells are drying up.
We've got a wonderful project that just opened up in Las Vegas called the Desert Living Center, which teaches people how to live in the desert. It's kind of funny that it's actually in Vegas, but it's located at the site where the original spring was coming out of the ground, which is what Las Vegas was named for. But the reality is that spring's gone dry many years ago. And so the idea here is for water conservation in this project. Actually, 100% of the wastewater is treated on site and then gets fed back into the landscape. So the remarkable thing about the project is that the more people that come and use the facility, the more water that's generated, the more water that goes back into the ground, and the lusher that the landscape gets. So it's really an incredible situation where dealing with the lack of an abundance or lack of water can really drive to new design ideas that really change the perception of people living in Vegas.
When you guys explain to people what you do, who may not be familiar with the whole notion of eco-friendly design and architecture, do you come into contact with naysayers who may ask you rather blunt questions and may have rather blunt arguments as to, well, I don't want to be at the end of a cycle of water that's been used nine times by the time I get to it. How do you respond to those sorts of statements? Or how do you respond to someone saying, you know, I own the land, and if I want to build it with whatever materials I want to use and have as large a footprint as I want, why shouldn't I?
Every project that we work on, we come across somebody somewhere on the design team, or maybe it's in the city, who doesn't know how to understand about treating wastewater on site. We're going to have come across somebody. And the thing to remember is that when you're asking people to change, it's a very uncomfortable proposition to give people. And so what you really have to do is listen to them and understand that you're not going to get through your goals unless you can work together with this person. And that's really what green building is all about. It really takes an integrated design team in which the mechanical engineer talks to Miller Hall, who designs the great space, so that the mechanical system can be smaller. And that integrated design process really requires that everyone just believes that by thinking a little bit harder, you can come across extraordinary results.
One of the main principles we use to design buildings often is a natural ventilation scheme, which is an old concept. I mean, it's any building before air conditioning had to be naturally ventilated or it was uncomfortable. So we're just getting back to some basics. I found myself in arguments with the naysayers who are arguing that they don't want the windows to be opened. And you can easily win that argument because everyone around says, hey, wait a second. I love to open the window, especially up here in the Northwest. And a lot of times we set up a building so that our mechanical ventilation system can be shut down, called a mixed mode system, and go on to natural ventilation. So we have to configure our building so that air can circulate through it naturally using principles like the stack effect and just cross circulation.
You know, here's a case where we were talking about more tools in your toolbox. The new technology allows us to hook the office computer system, the little intranet or the, you know, the server for the office computers, right into the DDC control system for the HVAC, for the mechanical system in the building. And it's a pretty easy thing to do, so that now if the conditions are right outside to open your windows because the chiller is not on, the air conditioning is not running, then it can send a signal to everybody's computer in the building. And a little icon comes up on their screen that says, yeah, it's safe to open a window. You know, this is the right time to do it. And when it's not, when the air conditioning is on and you don't want to just be losing all that energy, it'll tell you that. So that's a case now where we have these great tools that we can use and still allow people to have control of their own environment. Because, you know, in some cases, you just can't naturally ventilate. You've got to put air conditioning in. But if you do, if we can use those tools so that people can open the windows when they should, we always try to do that.
You know, when we're talking about air conditioning in buildings, I think the thing to remember is that air conditioning is a technology that has allowed us to build in a certain way. It's allowed us to ignore certain things like, where does the sun come from? We can have deeper buildings because we don't need to have narrower to get natural ventilation through the space. And so people are just designed mentally. They've just gone through their profession as, this is the way that we mitigate risk. There's no risk involved in throwing in an air conditioning unit. And suddenly when someone comes along and says, hey, I want to open my window, that can really be tough to take for some designers.
That throws the whole thing off.
So you have to talk to them. And one of the fascinating things about opening a window is that there are surveys out there that say that when someone has control over their window, that we can accept wider temperature ranges inside the building because we have some type of control over our thermal environment. If we seal up the building, then people expect that it has to be exactly 72 degrees no matter what the weather is outside, and we lose that connection. So when we talk about things like natural ventilation and daylight, we're really just kind of connecting back to the fact that we're human beings and we like to be connected to our environment.
Well, that's so funny you mentioned that, too, because, you know, you're right. I mean, if you're sitting there in front of a little air conditioning unit, you know, I want it 72 degrees and I want it to be going off every 12 minutes. And, you know, you're looking at a number. You're not looking at the way you feel and what's comfortable for you.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Do you guys do a lot of renovation projects? Do your firms handle big renovation deals with old buildings?
That's definitely a great thing to help the sustainability movement, is just not tearing buildings down if they're not ready to be torn down. And we've been involved in some. I think that's really taken off. Look at what Portland has done with a lot of their old buildings. The beauty of the Pearl District, I think, is that they were able to save a lot of those old buildings and reuse them, and so that they're not just raising it and starting over.
The other side of that coin is, as we do build new buildings, to think about them in terms of being 50, 7500 year buildings. There was a while there where a lot of buildings were designed just to be 25 year buildings and torn down at the end of 25 years. Now we try to set goals that this is going to be at least a 50 year building. It's going to hold up. It's going to be a low level of maintenance for that amount of time, and it's going to be planned in a way that's flexible, that it can undergo a lot of change, even completely different from what it was originally set out to do. So we look at trying to plan buildings with a lot of flexibility so they last a long time and people love them.
You know, I think that's a really great point, because we're probably, this summer, we may hit $4 a gallon of gas. And we all know that it's only going to go up in the future. So if we go back and start designing buildings that maybe are less energy dependent or don't require any energy at all, then suddenly we've got buildings that can survive an impending oil crisis or a climate change, because the building has future-proofed itself because it isn't designed around a technology that requires fossil fuels to run.
What would be a worst-case scenario for the absolute wrong type of structure you'd have to deal with? How would you take the worst-case building and make it into a best-case scenario? Hi, welcome to the enormous question portion of the show.
I can think of a fairly bad example for a building that's going to be very difficult to reuse someday, and that's the Experience Music Project. Imagine Paul Allen finally folds up shop over there. I've imagined some uses for it. It could turn into a group of bars where you pay to get in once, and you get to go see all different kinds of shows. Maybe. But there are very few things you could actually reuse that building for. It's such a specific building. It'll be difficult to see that one last a long time, other than the fact that it's just so strange, people might want to keep it.
Hey, Tommy, can I do a little self-promoting here for our firm?
Sure.
On the other end of the spectrum, I just thought of a project that my partner Dave Miller designed for the same company, Paul Allen, as his Vulcan Group. And they do a lot of good sustainable building. And we did the Discovery Center over there right opposite the 2200 Westlake project. It's the sales center for the condominiums. And that building was built so that it can be moved. It can be completely disassembled, put on trucks, flatbed trucks, moved somewhere else in this city or another city, and bolted back together. There's very little footprint damage done because the foundation is on pure footings. The stormwater is all handled right there on site. It's just disconnecting the sewer connection and the water connection and the power and phones. And you can move that building anywhere. And you're starting to see that coming back in residential design too. There are some great prefab houses out there right now from some of these hotter design firms, Marmol Rad Senior down in LA. They have some fantastic prefab houses that I think you're going to start to see more of that prefabrication technology coming back.
And there's another technical movement afoot that my wife went to see a great lecture of a German engineer, Werner Sobeck, I think his name was, and she came back real excited about how he talks about not gluing your building together with caulking and sealant, but using gaskets so the whole thing could be taken apart someday and all those parts reused and not stuck together and have to be demolished. They can actually be disassembled and reconfigured.
I think at the opposite end of the scale of open building systems, which is this ability to take things apart and recycle and reuse, is the fact that look at our historic building stock. I mean, go down here to Pioneer Square and you see an incredible array of buildings that have survived 100 years. They've survived earthquakes. They've survived multiple different types of tenants. They've survived the advent of air conditioning. They've survived all kinds of things. And I think as architects and planners, if we use those types of buildings as a model for a way of designing new buildings, can we design new buildings downtown that can accept, are we designing for our occupant now or are we designing for the occupant in 50 years? It poses a completely different design challenge, but one in a way that really adds to the fabric of the city instead of this kind of disposable architecture that we see propagating throughout.
I got to tell you, Craig, you were very, very excited about talking about prefabricated, and that's almost like a loaded word, you know, when it comes to, do I want to buy something that's been prefabbed like that?
Sounds like a mobile home, doesn't it?
Yeah. But you know, the notion of the idea that you can literally pick up and move, boy, it does change the whole idea of moving, doesn't it? But you can unscrew your house and take it with you, and all you're paying for is the lot that you're on, and you already own the thing that you're going to put on it. I guess there's some folks in the status quo that may not be too cool with that whole idea. What, you're going to move your house with you? You know, or I love the idea of the mobile building. You know, you could be driving down the street and, wait a second, I saw that building over on Westlake a couple of years ago. What's it doing over here now? How did it get over here?
Yeah, right. And it used to be a sales center, and now it's a kayak shop or whatever.
Yeah, I was involved in a fantastic project during my graduate work at the University of Texas at Austin, which was a solar decathlon house in which we designed the building in Austin. We took it apart. We fit it on 4 flatbed trucks. We built it in 3 days on the Washington, D.C. Mall and ran it completely off of solar energy, and then brought out our ratchet set and dismantled the building, put it back on 4 trucks, and it came back to Austin where it now resides. And the fascinating thing is every time I go back to that building, there's been something that's been added to it or something that's been remodeled. And the theory here is that imagine if you've got a household of 4 kids and 2 go off to college. Suddenly you take out your ratchet and you disassemble your bedroom, move it to the other side of the house and turn it into a study or increase your living area. And then, you know, maybe you have a grandparent that needs the space, needs to be moved back in. So you take that, you disassemble another part of your house and move it to some place that is a bit more quiet and a little bit away from the hustle and bustle. And so it's a theory that is really starting to take hold because of just the possibility and the ability to recycle buildings and to reuse things. You know, these aren't old concepts, but we're using newer technologies to solve those problems.
And this is cost efficient. This wouldn't cost you any more than your average house. Not that they aren't expensive enough as it is.
It just takes a little bit more time to think about it. And I think that's what's really fascinating is green buildings, the projects we work on, we don't get extra money to add on solar panels. If we want to add on solar panels, we got to figure out a smart way to cost shift from some other part of the building. And that's, it really comes down to study and some detailed technical analysis to make sure that every dollar you're spending in construction, you're using it to its maximum effectiveness.
But, you know, we've got to be realistic, too. Some of these things do cost a little bit more up front, but they may pay for themselves in no time. You know, a lot of times these things we're doing, within 5 years, the owner is seeing a payback. And if it's an owner-occupied building, you know, these things we're talking about today, they make financial sense.
One of our largest clients is PNC Bank, which is a financial institute, and they're building 100 new green branches on the eastern seaboard. And the reason why they're doing that is because it makes financial sense. They own these buildings for 20 years. And so if they add, you know, 1 or 2% to the first cost, which is why a lot of people kind of balk at the cost of green buildings, they're only looking at that first cost. But when, as Craig said, when you run the numbers and evaluate it, if energy prices stayed the same, when does it pay back? And PNC won't do any features that don't pay back within 10 years because that's sound financial strategy.
Yeah, it's that, and that's what people want now. Almost all of our clients, and this is a real shift in the last 5 years, almost every one of our clients comes to us and they want to know what we're going to do for sustainable building. They're demanding it. And it's not just public projects. It's all of our private work, too. Even condominium projects. We're doing work in Scottsdale, Phoenix, Arizona, you know, a very conservative state. They're asking for it. You know, it's really spreading. We're lucky, though, in the Northwest. We are so far ahead of a lot of the rest of the country, the West Coast in particular, but Seattle is way out there. We're doing work across the country, and it's definitely not at the point yet to where we are here.
You know, I think, Craig, you nailed it in the past 5 years. And 5 years ago, we were talking about what we were talking about just now. It doesn't make good financial business case. And I think, especially in the last year, we have clients coming to us and saying, how can you help us with climate change? How can you help us reduce our carbon footprint? And to us, that is incredibly exciting because suddenly we're talking about different things. And it's opening up the realm of possibility to think beyond the cost number, because we already know it makes business sense. But we're doing it because as a corporate citizen, we have to start to deal with the situation that we're facing.
So what made the change in attitude happen? And just a couple of years ago, and I couldn't agree with you more, and I've seen the change happen, but I can't imagine it's all Al Gore. I can't imagine it's all because of global warming and the awareness of that. I mean, there has to be something else. There's something in the back of my head that tells me there's got to be some financial thing here that there's just something smart dollar-wise for doing this beyond just, you know, feel good or Al Gore or whatever.
You can't claim the internet and also solve global warming. We can't let them have both of those.
Be a good card trick, though. You know?
I don't know if it's just demographic. I mean, that's something it's been puzzling to me too. And I think that's just this new generation. You know, one thing that we've seen is in our university projects, it's the students who are demanding it. We did a project at the University of Washington, the first LEED building on their main campus, and there was a lot of skepticism from the administration, from the Capitol Facilities Office in the beginning, but the students were pushing really hard for it. And the users of that particular building were pushing hard for it. So we got it through, and now, you know, it's working. People realize that it didn't necessarily cost any more, saving them money. And if the students want it, these buildings are for the students.
You know, nobody likes to hear all the time that they're part of the problem. And, you know, we can't go on MSN these days and not be have something on the front page talking about carbon footprint or Al Gore, for example. And people want to be part of the solution. I truly believe that as a society that we're facing a crisis, but people are the answer. And so people are really starting to get excited and understand that they can make a difference in their daily work environment and, you know, it doesn't cost anymore. There's always going to be the cost issue.
I also think that there are now a lot of everyday buildings that were designed and built sustainably, and people like the results. They feel more connected to where they are, and so the product is good. It sells well to everybody. And now it's catching on, so there's more and more examples, and it's reinforcing itself.
Craig and Mike, is there something that the Miller Hall Partnership is working on right now? Any projects we might want to be looking forward? Maybe not necessarily a grass on top of the library, but something similar?
Well, I think there's a movement right now that goes beyond LEED. We've been talking about this LEED, which is Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. It's kind of the new standard that people are designing buildings to, a standard put together by the U.S. Green Building Council. But if you go beyond that and really start talking about things that Brad was mentioning earlier about just trying to save the planet, there's something called net zero energy that is, I think, even a better goal to have as architects, to try to put together buildings that actually produce more energy than they use, or at least as much as they use, and on an annual basis. And we have two projects on the boards right now that are both destined to be net zero projects. And that's really exciting to think about, you know, turning over a building to an owner and knowing that they're not going to have a utility bill and they're not paying for Middle East oil or even oil from our friends up in Canada. It's pretty exciting to see. And it's a rare occasion where you have just, you know, everything has to fall into place to be able to do it. But I think there are opportunities out there. We just have to look for them.
And Brad, is there anything going on with Paladino we might want to keep an eye out for in the next couple of years?
Sure. One of our most exciting projects is we're working on the USS Arizona Memorial Visitor Center in Pearl Harbor. And as we all know, one of the reasons why we were attacked by Japan was over the conflict about oil. And if you look at the situation in Hawaii today, they use 90% of their energy comes from oil. And so there's an incredible opportunity here that we're faced with, that we can really use the building to educate 1.8 million visitors that come there a year to learn about why we were attacked. And so this building is designed with natural ventilation studies, and the museum environment is passively ventilated. It's not going to be an inside air-conditioned box. It's going to be part of the environment. And so the transformative power of this project in conjunction with its goals and a wonderful client in the National Park Service who understands the issues in climate change, it's an opportunity that is really a chance in a lifetime for myself, and I feel very fortunate to be a part of the team that we're working on that project with.
Hey, I want to thank you guys for joining us this morning. This has been a wonderful discussion, and wonderful to have you guys here. Craig Curtis and Mike Jobes, Miller Hall Partnership in Seattle, and Brad Peace from the Seattle firm of Paladino & Company Green Building Strategies. Wonderful to have you guys here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Well, that is going to about do it for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International, but we will be back next Sunday morning at 7:30, right before Jim Keller and Resurrection Flashback Sunday. You can always go back to the Tree Huggers International page at 1077theend.com and listen to previous editions of Tree Huggers International. You can also go to the Tree Huggers International page, which is treehuggersintl.com. And please keep sending me the photographs of you hugging trees along the trail. We will get a gallery together and post all of them. You can email those pictures to me at though@entercom.com. That's Tommy Howe, though@entercom.com. We'll talk to you again next Sunday morning at 7:30. In the meantime, relax and sit back and enjoy Jim Keller and Resurrection Flashback Sunday on the way next on 1077 The End. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next Sunday. See ya.